Roche heard her confession, looking worn out. They were all worn out. If they sat down to rest, they were asleep in seconds. The steward coming in to look at his son, Lafric, had stood at the barricade, snoring, and Kivrin had dozed off while tending the fire and burned her hand badly. We can't go on like this, she thought, watching Father Roche making the sign of the cross over Eloise. He'll die of exhaustion. He'll come down with the plague. I have to get them away, she thought again. The plague didn't reach everywhere. There were villages that were completely untouched. It had skipped over Poland and Bohemia, and there were parts of northern Scotland it had never reached.
Agnus Dei, qui tollis peccata mundi, miserere nobis, Father Roche said,
his voice as comforting as it had been when she was dying, and she knew it was hopeless. He would never leave his parishioners. The history of the Black Death was full of stories of priests who had abandoned their people, who had refused to perform burials, who had locked themselves in their churches and monasteries or run away. She wondered now if those statistics were inaccurate too. And even if she found some way to take them all, Eloise, turning even now as she made her confession to look at the door, would insist on waiting for Garwin, for her husband to come, as she was convinced they would now that the snow had stopped.
Has Father Roche gone to meet them?
She asked Kivrin when Roche left to take the sacraments back to the church.
He will be here soon.
He has no doubt gone first to Courcy to warn them of the plague, and it is only half a day's journey from there. She insisted that Kivrin move her pallet in front of the door. While Kivrin was rearranging the barricade to keep the draught from the door off her, the clerk cried out suddenly and went into convulsions. His whole body spasmed as if he were being shocked, and his face became a terrible rictus, his ulcerated eye staring upward. "Don't do this to him," Kivrin shouted, trying to wedge the spoon from Rosamond's broth between his teeth. "Hasn't he been through enough?" His body jerked. "Stop it," Kivrin sobbed. "Stop it." His body abruptly slackened. She jammed the spoon between his teeth, and a little trickle of black slime came out of the side of his mouth.
"He's dead,"
she thought, and could not believe it. She looked at him, his ulcerated eye half open, his face swollen and blackened under the stubble of his beard. His fists were clenched at his side. He did not look human lying there, and Kivrin covered his face with a rough blanket, afraid that Rosamond might see him.
"Is he dead?"
Rosamond asked, sitting up curiously.
"Yes,"
Kivrin said.
"Thank God."
She stood up. "I must go tell Father Roche." "I would not have you leave me here alone," Rosamond said.
"Your mother is here," Kivrin said,
"and the steward's son, and I will only be a few minutes."
"I am afraid," Rosamond said.
"So am I," Kivrin thought, looking down at the coarse blanket.
He was dead, but even that had not relieved his suffering. He looked still in anguish, still in terror,
though his face no longer looked even human.
"The pains of hell. Please, do not leave me," Rosamond said. "I must tell Father Roche,"
Kivrin said, but she sat down between the clerk and Rosamond and waited until she was asleep before she went to find him. He wasn't in the courtyard or the kitchen. The steward's cow was in the passage, eating the hay from the bottom of the pigsty, and it ambled after her out onto the green. The steward was in the churchyard, digging a grave. his chest level with the snowy ground.
He already knows,
she thought. But that was impossible. Her heart began to pound. Where is Father Roche? She called. But the steward didn't answer or look up. The cow came up beside her and lowed at her. Go away, she said, and ran across to the steward. The grave was not in the churchyard. It lay on the green past the lych gate, and there were two other graves in a line next to it, the iron-hard dirt piled on the snow beside each one. What are you doing? She demanded. Whose graves are those? The steward flung a spadeful of dirt onto the mound. The frozen clods made a clattering sound like stones. Why do you dig three graves? She said. Who have died? The cow nudged her shoulder with its horn. She twisted away from it. Who has died? The steward jabbed the spade into the iron-hard ground.
It is the last days, boy, he said,
stepping down hard on the blade. And Kivrin felt a jerk of fear and then realized he hadn't recognized her in her boy's clothes.
It's me. Catherine, she said.
He looked up and nodded.
It is the end of time, he said. Those who have not died will.
He leaned forward, putting his whole weight on the spade. The cow tried to dig his head in under her arm. Go away, she said, and hit it on the nose. It backed away gingerly, skirting the graves. And Kivrin noticed they were not all the same size. The first was large, but the one next to it was no bigger than Agnes's had been. And the one he stood in did not look much longer.
I told Rosamond he wasn't digging her grave, she thought. But he was.
You have no right to do this, she said. Your son and Rosamond are getting better, and Lady Eloise is only tired and ill with grief. They aren't going to die.
The steward looked up at her, his face as expressionless as when he had stood at the barricade, measuring Rosamond for her grave. Father Roche says you were sent to help us. But how can you avail against the end of the world?
He stood down on the spade again.
You will have need of these graves. All will die.
The cow trotted over to the opposite side of the grave, its face on a level with the steward's, and lowed in his face, but he did not seem to notice it. You must not dig any more graves, she said. I forbid it. He went on digging, as if he had not noticed her either. They're not going to die, she said. The Black Death only killed one-third to one-half of the contempts. We've already had our quota. He went on digging. Eloise died in the night. The steward had to lengthen Rosamond's grave for Eloise. And when they buried her, Kivrin saw he had started another for Rosamond.
I must get them away from here, she thought,
looking at the steward. He stood with the spade cradled against his shoulder, and as soon as he had filled in Eloise's grave, he started in on Rosamond's grave again.
I must get them away before they catch it.
Because they were going to catch it. It lay in wait for them, in the bastille, on their clothes, on the bedding, in the very air they breathed. And if by some miracle they didn't catch it from that, the plague would sweep through all of Oxfordshire in the spring. Messengers and villagers and bishops' envoys. They could not stay here.
Scotland, she thought,
and started for the manor.
I could take them to northern Scotland.
The plague didn't reach that far. The steward's son could ride the donkey, and they could make a litter for Rosamond. Rosamond was sitting up on her pallet.
The steward's son has been crying out for you,
she said as soon as Kivrin came in. He had vomited a bloody mucus. His palate was filthy with it, and when Kivrin cleaned him up, he was too weak to raise his head.
Even if Rosamond can ride, he can't, she thought despairingly. We're not going anywhere.
In the night, she thought of the wagon that had been at the rendezvous. Perhaps the steward could help her repair it, and Rosamond could ride in that. She lit a rushlight from the coals of the fire and crept out to the stable to look at it. Roche's donkey brayed at her when she opened the door, and there was a rustling sound of sudden scattering as she held the smoky light up. The smashed boxes lay piled against the wagon like a barricade, and she knew as soon as she pulled them away that it wouldn't work. It was too big. The donkey could not pull it, and the wooden axle was missing, carried off by some enterprising contempt to mend a hedge with or burn for firewood, or to stave off the plague with, Kivrin thought. It was pitch black in the courtyard when she came out, and the stars were sharp and bright, as they had been Christmas Eve. She thought of Agnes asleep against her shoulder, the bell on her little wrist, and the sound of the bells tolling the devil's knell. Prematurely, Kivrin thought, the devil isn't dead yet. He's loosed on the world. She lay awake a long time, trying to think of another plan. Perhaps they could make some sort of litter the donkey could drag if the snow wasn't too deep. Or perhaps they could put both children on the donkey and carry the baggage in packs on their backs. She fell asleep finally, and was awakened again, almost immediately, or so it seemed to her. It was still dark, and Roche was bending over her. The dying fire lit his face from below, so that he looked as he had in the clearing when she had thought he was a cutthroat, and still partly asleep. She reached out and put her hand gently on his cheek.
Lady Catherine,
he said, and she came awake. It's Rosamond, she thought, and twisted round to look at her. But she was sleeping easily, a thin hand under her cheek.
What is it? She said.
Are you ill? He shook his head. He opened his mouth and then closed it again.
Has someone come? She said, scrambling to her feet.
He shook his head again.
Can't be someone ill, she thought. There's no one left.
She looked at the pile of blankets by the door where the steward slept. But he wasn't there.
Is the steward ill?
The steward's son is dead,
he said in an odd, stunned voice. And she saw that Lefric was gone too.
I went to the church to say matins,
Roche said, and his voice faltered.
You must come with me,
he said, and strode out. Kivrin snatched up her ragged blanket and hurried out into the courtyard after him. It could not be later than 6. The sun was only just above the horizon, staining the overcast sky and the snow with pink. Roche was already disappearing through the narrow passage to the green. Kivrin flung the blanket over her shoulders and ran after him. The steward's cow was standing in the passage, its head through a break in the fence of the pigsty, pulling at the straw. It raised its head and mooed at Kivrin. Shoo, she said, flapping her hands at it. But it only pulled its head out of the wattle fence and started toward her, lowing.
I don't have time to milk you, she said,
and shoved its hindquarters out of the way and squeezed past. Father Roche was halfway across the green before she caught up with him.
What is it? Can't you tell me? She asked.
But he didn't stop or even look at her. He turned toward the line of graves on the green, and she thought, feeling suddenly relieved. The steward tried to bury his son himself without a priest. The small grave was filled in, the snowy dirt mounded over it. And he had finished Rosamond's grave and dug another, larger one. The spade was sticking out of it, its handle leaning against the end. Roche didn't go to Lefric's grave.
He stopped at the nearest one and said in that same stunned voice,
I went to the church to say matins.
And Kivrin looked into the grave.
The steward had apparently tried to bury himself with the shovel, but it had proved unwieldy in the narrow space, and he had propped it against the end of the grave and begun pulling the dirt down with his hands. He held a large clod in his frozen hand. His legs were nearly covered, and it gave him an indecent look, as if he were lying in his bath.
We must bury him properly, she said, and reached for the shovel. Roche shook his head.
It is holy ground, he said numbly.
And she realized that he thought the steward had killed himself. It doesn't matter, she thought, and realized in spite of everything, horror after horror, Roche still believed in God. He had been going to the church to say matins when he found the steward, and if they had all died, he would go on saying them and not find anything incongruous in his prayers.
It's a disease, Kivrin said,
though she had no idea whether it was or not. The septicemic plague. It infects the blood. Roche looked at her uncomprehendingly.
He must have fallen ill while he was digging, she said.
Septicemic plague poisons the brain. He was not in his right mind.
Like Lady Hermione, he said, sounding almost glad.
He didn't want to have to bury him outside the pale, Kivrin thought, in spite of what he believes.
She helped Roche straighten the steward's body a little, though he was already stiff. They did not attempt to move him or wrap him in a shroud. Roche laid a black cloth over his face, and they took turns shoveling the dirt in on him. The frozen earth clattered like stones. Roche did not go to the church for his vestments or the missal. He stood first beside Lefric's grave, and then the steward's, and said the prayers for the dead. Kivrin, standing beside him, her hands folded, thought, he wasn't in his right mind. He had buried his wife and 6 children. He had buried almost everyone he knew. And even if he hadn't been feverish, if he had crawled into the grave and waited to freeze to death, the plague had still killed him. He did not deserve a suicide's grave. He doesn't deserve any grave, Kivrin thought. He was supposed to go to Scotland with us. And was horrified at the sudden shock of delight she felt. We can go to Scotland now, she thought, looking at the grave he had dug for Rosamond. Rosamond can ride the donkey, and Roche and I can carry the food and blankets. She opened her eyes and looked at the sky. But now that the sun was up, the clouds looked lighter, as if they might break up by mid-morning. If they left this morning, they could be out of the forest by noon and onto the Oxford Bath Road. By night, they could be on the highway to York.
Agnus Dei, qui tollis peccata mundi, Roche said. Dona eis requiem.
We must take oats for the donkey, she thought, and the axe for cutting firewood, and blankets.
Roche finished the prayers.
Dominus vobiscum et conspiritu tuo, he said. Requiescat in pace. Amen.
He started off to ring the bell.
There isn't time for that, Kivrin thought, and then took off toward the manor.
She could be half packed by the time Roche had told the death knell, and she could tell him her plan, and he could load the donkey, and they could go. She ran across the courtyard and into the manor. They would have to take coals to start the fire with. They could use the miner's medicine casket. She went into the hall. Rosamond was still asleep. That was good. There was no point in waking her until they were ready to leave. She tiptoed past her and got the casket and emptied it out. She laid it next to the fire and started out to the kitchen.
I woke, and you were not here, Rosamond said.
She sat up on her pallet.
I was afraid you had gone.
We're all going, Kivrin said. We're going to go to Scotland. She went over to her. You must rest for the journey. I will be back in a bit.
Where are you going? Rosamond said.
Only to the kitchen. Are you hungry? I will bring you some porridge. Now lie down and rest.
I do not like to be alone, Rosamond said. Can you not stay with me a little?
I don't have time for this, Kivrin thought.
I'm only going to the kitchen, and Father Roche is here. Can't you hear him?
He's ringing the bell. I'll only be a few minutes, all right? She smiled cheerfully at Rosamond, and she nodded reluctantly.
I'll be back soon.
She nearly ran outside.
Roche was still ringing the death knell, slowly, steadily.
Hurry, she thought. We don't have much time. She searched the kitchen, setting the food on the table. There was a round of cheese and plenty of manchets left. She stacked them like plates in a Wadmore sack, put in the cheese and carried it out to the well. Rosamond was standing in the door of the manor, holding on to the jam.
Can I not sit in the kitchen with you? She asked.
She had put on her kirtle and her shoes, but she was already shivering in the cold air.
It's too cold,
Kivrin said, hurrying over to her, and you must rest.
When you are gone, I fear you will not come back, she said.
I'm right here, Kivrin said. But she went inside and fetched Rosamond's cloak and an armload of furs. You can sit here on the doorstep, she said, and watch me pack. She put the cloak over Rosamond's shoulders and sat her down, piling the furs about her like a nest. All right. The brooch that Sir Blowett had given Rosamond was still at the neck of the cloak. She fumbled with the fastening, her thin hands trembling a little.
Do we go to Courcy? She asked.
No, Kivrin said, and pinned the brooch for her. Io Suisien Lui Dami Amo. You are here in place of the friend I love.
We're going to Scotland.
We will be safe from the plague there.
Think you my father died from the plague?
Kivrin hesitated.
My mother said he was only delayed or unable to come. She said perhaps my brothers were ill, and he would come when they were recovered.
And so he may, Kivrin said, tucking a fur around Rosamond's feet.
We'll leave a letter for him, so he'll know where we went.
Rosamond shook her head.
If he lived, he would have come for me.
Kivrin wrapped a coverlet around Rosamond's thin shoulders. I must fetch food for us to take, Kivrin said gently. Rosamond nodded, and Kivrin went across to the kitchen. There was a sack of onions against the wall, and another of apples. They were wizened, and most of them had brown spots, but Kivrin lugged the sack outside. They would not need to be cooked, and they would all be in need of vitamins before spring.
Would you like an apple? She asked Rosamond.
Yes, Rosamond said, and Kivrin searched through the sack, trying to find one that was still firm and unwrinkled. She unearthed a reddish-green one, polished it on her leather hose, and took it to her, smiling at the memory of how good an apple would have tasted when she was ill. But after the first bite, Rosamond seemed to lose interest. She leaned back against the door jamb and looked quietly up at the sky, listening to the steady toll of Roche's bell. Kivrin went back to sorting the apples, picking out the ones worth taking, and wondering how much the donkey could carry. They would need to take oats for the donkey. There would be no grass. So when they reached Scotland, there might be heather that it could eat. They shouldn't have to take water. There were plenty of streams. But they would need to take a pot to boil it in.
Your people never came for you, Rosamond said.
Kivrin looked up. She was still sitting against the door with the apple.
They did come, Kivrin thought. But I wasn't there.
No,
Kivrin said.
Think you the plague has killed them?
No, Kivrin said, and thought, at least I don't have to think of them dead or helpless somewhere. At least I know they're all right.
When I go to Sir Blowett, I will tell him how you helped us, Rosamond said. I will ask that I might keep you and Father Roche by me.
Her head went up proudly.
I am allowed my own attendants and chaplain.
Thank you, Kivrin said solemnly. She set the sack of good apples next to the one of cheese and bread. The bell stopped, its overtones still echoing in the cold air. She picked up the bucket and lowered it into the well. She would cook some porridge and chop the bruised apples into it. It would make a filling meal for the trip.
Rosamond's apple rolled past her feet to the base of the well and stopped.
Kivrin stooped to pick it up. It had only a little bite out of it, white against the shriveled red. Kivrin wiped it against her jerkin.
You dropped your apple, she said, and turned to give it back to her. Her hand was still open, as if she had leaned forward to catch it when it fell.
Oh, Rosamond, Kivrin said.
Transcript from the Doomsday Book. Father Roche and I are going to Scotland. There really isn't any point in telling you that, I suppose. Since you'll never hear what's on this corder. But perhaps someone will stumble across it on a moor someday, or Miss Montoya will do a dig in northern Scotland when she's finished with Skengate. And if that happens, I wanted you to know what happened to us. I know flight is probably the worst thing to do, but I have to get Father Roche away from here. The whole manor is contaminated with the plague. Bedding, clothes, the air, and the rats are everywhere. I saw one in the church when I went to get Roche's alb and stole for Rosamond's funeral. And even if he doesn't catch it from them, the plague is all around us. And I will never be able to convince him to stay here. He will want to go and help. We'll keep off the roads and away from the villages. We've got food enough for a week. And then we'll be far enough north that I should be able to buy food in a town. The clerk had a sack of silver with him. And don't worry. We'll be all right. As Mr. Gilchrist would say, I've taken every possible precaution. Chapter 32.
Apocalyptic was very likely the correct term for his even thinking he could rescue Kivrin, Dunworthy thought.
He was worn out by the time Colin got him back to his room, and his temp was back up.
You rest, Colin said, helping him into bed. You can't have a relapse if you're going to rescue Kivrin.
I need to see Badri, he said, and Finch.
I'll take care of everything, Colin said, and darted out.
He would need to arrange his and Badri's discharge and med support for the pickup in case Kivrin was ill. He would need a plague inoculation. He wondered how long would be required for it to take effect. Mary had said she'd immunize Kivrin while she was in hospital for her corder implant. That had been 2 weeks before the drop, but perhaps it didn't take that long to confer immunity. The nurse came in to check his temp. I'm just going off duty, she said, reading his patch.
How soon can I be discharged?
He asked. Discharged? She said, sounding surprised. My, you must be feeling better.
I am, he said. How long?
She frowned. There's a good deal of difference between being ready for a bit of a walk and being ready to go home. She adjusted the drip. You don't want to overdo. She went out, and after a few minutes, Colin came in with Finch and the Middle Ages book. I thought perhaps you'd need this for costumes and things. He dumped it on Dunworthy's legs. I'll just go fetch Badri. He dashed out.
You're looking a good deal better, sir, Finch said. I'm so glad. I'm afraid you're badly needed at Balliol. It's Mrs. Gadsden. She's accused Balliol of undermining William's health. She says the combined strain of the epidemic and reading Petrarch has broken his health. She's threatening to go to the head of the history faculty with it.
Tell her she's more than welcome to try. Basingham's in Scotland somewhere,
Dunworthy said.
I need you to find how long in advance of exposure an inoculation against bubonic plague needs to be given, and I need the laboratory readied for a drop.
We're using it for storage just now, Finch said. We've had several shipments of supplies from London, though none of lavatory paper, even though I specifically requested...
Move them into the hall, Dunworthy said. I want the net ready as soon as possible.
Colin opened the door with his elbow and wheeled Badri in, using his other arm and a knee to hold it open.
I had to sneak him past the ward sister, he said breathlessly.
He pushed the wheelchair up to the bed.
I want...
Dunworthy said and stopped, looking at Badri. The thing was impossible. Badri was in no condition to run the net. He looked exhausted by the mere effort of having been brought from the ward, and he was fumbling at the pocket of his robe as he had at his sash.
We'll need 2 RTNs, a light measure and a gateway,
Badri said, and his voice sounded exhausted too, but the despair had gone out of it.
And we'll need authorizations for both drop and pickup.
What about the protesters who were at Brazenose?
Dunworthy asked.
Will they try to prevent the drop?
No, Colin said. They're over at the National Trust headquarters. They're trying to shut down the dig.
Good, Dunworthy thought. Montoya will be too occupied with trying to defend her churchyard against picketers to interfere. Too occupied to look for Kivrin's quarter. What else will you need?
He asked Badri.
An insular memory and redundant for the backup.
He pulled a sheet of paper from the pocket and looked at it.
And a remote hookup so I can run parameter checks.
He handed the list to Dunworthy, who handed it to Finch.
We'll also need med support for Kivrin, Dunworthy said. And I want a telephone installed in this room.
Finch was frowning at the list.
And don't tell me we're out of any of these, Dunworthy said before he could protest. Beg, borrow, or steal them.
He turned back to Badri.
Will you need anything else?
To be discharged, Badri said, which I'm afraid will be the greatest obstacle.
He's right, Colin said. Sister will never let him out. I had to sneak him in here.
Who's your doctor?
Dunworthy asked.
Dr. Gates, Badri said,
but...
Surely we can explain the situation,
Dunworthy interrupted.
Explain that it's an emergency.
Badri shook his head.
The last thing we can do is tell him the circumstances. I persuaded him to discharge me to open the net while you were ill. He didn't think I was well enough, but he allowed it. And then when I had the relapse...
Dunworthy looked anxiously at him.
Are you certain you're capable of running the net? Perhaps I can get Andrews now that the epidemic's under control.
There isn't time, Badri said. And it was my fault. I want to run the net. Perhaps Mr. Finch can find another doctor.
Yes, Dunworthy said. And tell mine I need to speak with him.
He reached for Colin's book.
I'll need a costume.
He flipped through the pages, looking for an illustration of medieval clothing.
No strips, no zippers, no buttons.
He found a picture of Boccaccio and showed it to Finch.
I doubt if 20th Century has anything. Telephone the Dramatic Society and see if they've got something.
I'll do my best, sir, Finch said, frowning doubtfully at the illustration. The door crashed open, and the sister rattled in, enraged.
Mr. Dunworthy, this is utterly irresponsible, she said, in a tone that had no doubt caused casualties from the Second Falklands War terrors. If you will not take care of your own health, you might at the least not endanger that of the other patients.
She fixed her gaze on Finch.
Mr. Dunworthy is to have no more visitors.
She glared at Colin, and then snatched the wheelchair handles from him.
What can you have been thinking of, Mr. Chowdhury?
She said, whipping the wheelchair around so smartly the G's head snapped back.
You have already had one relapse. I have no intention of allowing you to have another.
She pushed him out.
I told you we'd never get him out, Colin said.
She flung the door open again.
No visitors,
she said to Colin.
I'll be back,
Colin whispered, and ducked past her. She fixed him with her ancient eye.
Not if I have anything to say about it.
She apparently had something to say about it. Colin didn't return till after she'd gone off duty, and then only to bring the remote hook-up to Badri and report to Dunworthy on plague inoculations. Finch had telephoned the NHS. It took 2 weeks for the inoculation to confer full immunity, and 7 days before partial. And Mr. Finch wants to know if you shouldn't also be inoculated against cholera and typhoid.
There isn't time, he said.
There wasn't time for a plague inoculation either. Kivrin had already been there over 3 weeks, and every day lowered her chances of survival, and he was no closer to being discharged. As soon as Colin left, he rang William's nurse and told her he wanted to see his doctor.
I'm ready to be discharged, he said.
She laughed.
I'm completely recovered, he said. I did 10 laps in the corridor this morning.
She shook her head. The incidence of relapse in this virus has been extremely high. I simply can't take the risk. She smiled at him. Where is it you're so determined to go? Surely whatever it is can survive another week without you.
It's the start of term, he said,
and realized that was true.
Please tell my doctor I wish to see him.
Dr. Warden will only tell you what I've told you, she said. But she apparently relayed the message because he tottered in after tea. He had obviously been hauled out of a senile retirement to help with the epidemic. He told a long and pointless story about medical conditions during the pandemic and then pronounced creakily, in my day we kept people in hospital till they were fully recovered. Dunworthy didn't try to argue with him. He waited until he and the sister had hobbled down the corridor, sharing reminiscences from the Hundred Years' War, and then strapped on his portable drip and walked to the public phone near casualties to get a progress report from Finch. The sister won't allow a phone in your room, Finch said, but I've good news about the plague. A course of streptomycin injections, along with gamma globulin and T-cell enhancement, will confer temporary immunity and can be started as little as 12 hours before exposure.
Good,
Dunworthy said.
Find me a doctor who'll give them and authorize my discharge. A young doctor. And send Colin over. Is the net ready?
Very nearly, sir. I've obtained the necessary drop and pickup authorizations, and I've located a remote hookup. I was just going to fetch it now.
He rang off, and Dunworthy walked back to the room. He hadn't lied to the nurse. He was feeling stronger with each passing moment. Though there was a tightness around his lower ribs by the time he made it back to his room. Mrs. Gadsden was there, searching eagerly through her Bible for murrhines and agues and emerods.
"Read me Luke 11, verse 9,
Dunworthy said. She looked it up.
"And I say unto you, ask, and it shall be given you,"
she read, glaring at him suspiciously.
"Seek, and ye shall find. Knock, and it shall be opened unto you."
Miss Taylor came at the very end of visiting hours, carrying a measuring tape. "Carlin sent me to get your measurements," she said. "The old crone out there won't let him on the floor." She draped the tape around his waist. "I had to tell her I was visiting Miss Piantini. Hold your arm out straight." She stretched the tape along his arm. "She's feeling a lot better. She may even get to ring Rambo's. When at last my saviour cometh, with us on the 15th. We're doing it for Holy Reformed, you know. But the NHS has taken over the church, so Mr. Finch has very kindly let us use Balliol's chapel. What size shoe do you wear?" She jotted down his various measurements, told him Colin would be in the next day, and not to worry, the net was nearly ready. She went out, presumably to visit Miss Piantini, and came back a few minutes later with a message from Badri. "Mr. Dunworthy, I've run 24 parameter checks," it read. "All 24 show minimal slippage. 11 show slippage of less than an hour. 5 slippage of less than 5 minutes. I'm running divergence checks and DARs to try to find out what it is."
"I know what it is," Dunworthy thought. "It's the Black Death. The function of the slippage was to prevent interactions that might affect history. 5 minutes slippage meant there were no anachronisms, no critical meetings the continuum must keep from happening. It meant the drop was to an uninhabited area. It meant the plague had been there, and all the contempts were dead."
This ends side 2 of cassette 16 of Doomsday Book. Please fast forward to the end before loading cassette 17.